him time to rethink his plan, but at least he was ready. The moment both the bartender and the flight attendant were inside the hotel room, the door shut behind them, he emerged from the darkened bathroom. He slammed the grip of his pistol into the back of Enrico's skull with his left hand and rammed the tip of Elena Orloff's stun gun against Bowden's gauzy little dress high on the rear of her thigh with his right. The bartender instantly collapsed to the carpet, unconscious, his shirt sponging up wet remnants of Elena's blood. The flight attendant grunted loudly, shuddered, and then went limp like a rag doll, just melted against him. She stared up at him as he lowered her to the rug beside the bartender, and he could see the terror in her eyes. She would be able to speak soon enough, and he did want to talk to her. But first he had to reevaluate what he was going to do. He dumped out the woman's purse and saw that she had gotten a gun. Perfect. He didn't care where she got it, he could use it. Elena had set the table rather nicely when she'd called the newspaper. The woman wouldn't overdose on the barbiturates the American spy had brought. Instead, he would leave behind a tableau for the world in which it seemed evident that Cassandra Bowden had killed her Italian lover and her new, wealthy Russian friend from Sochi, and then shot herself in the head with the gun she must have gone to such great lengths to acquire. First, however, he had to transfer the silencer from his Beretta to hers.
Chapter 34. The taser was excruciating, and Cassie wanted to scream. In her mind, she imagined a blue streak of expletives, a woman with a foul mouth and an impressive vocabulary unleashing it all in the throes of labor, but she could only moan long and low. And then she was on her stomach on the hotel room floor, just outside the bathroom door, and there was Buckley crouching beside her. Yes, it was the actor. Of course it was. He was actually wearing that same black ball cap. He or she had been so obsessed with Miranda, and all along it had been a person she thought was sweet and well-meaning and actually a bit of a puppy dog. It was a testimony to just how badly she appraised people and picked her friends. And it might have been comic if he weren't going to kill her the way that he or one of his associates had, she presumed, killed Alex. He was going to grab a handful of her hair, pull back her head to expose her neck, and cut her throat. Probably poor Enrico's, too, and leave her face down on the hotel room rug to bleed out. Cassie hoped it wouldn't hurt, but she knew it would. She realized that she was most afraid of the pain, the sharp, brief, razor-like sting of the blade slicing into her skin. And maybe that explained why she drank. Pain came in all colors and sizes, much of it far worse than the pricks and aches and fever dreams that affected the body. This was the pain that gouged out great holes in the soul, hollowing out self-esteem and cratering a person's self-respect. This was the pain that caused you to gaze at yourself in the mirror and wonder why in the name of God you were here. Cassie understood that her life was a study in precisely this sort of palliative management. Or, to be precise, mismanagement. Her tongue felt thick and heavy from the taser, and as she watched the contents of her purse spilled out in front of her, she tried to turn her guttural moaning into words. She had one sentence she had to say, and she wished it was the two words, "I'm sorry." Or maybe something more specific, "I'm sorry I didn't do more. I'm sorry I was unlovable or incapable of being loved. I'm sorry I never had children, or even a cat of my own. I'm sorry, Rosemary. I'm sorry, Jessica. I'm sorry, Dennis. I'm sorry, Tim. I'm sorry, Alex. I'm sorry, Enrico." God, Enrico. About to be killed for no other reason than that he was chivalrous. A young romantic who had walked her back to her room. She never should have let him. One more mistake of hers with consequences for others. Would any of these people miss her? Would Megan? Jillian? Paula? Would anyone really and truly miss her? Supposedly, whatever we do that's selfish goes with us to the grave. Whatever we do that's selfless lives on. She couldn't imagine a single thing she had done, a single act, that had even hinted at immortality. Her legacy? She had no legacy. She could feel her cheeks were wet and she was crying, which she hadn't expected. She had been told over the years by pilots, usually when they were having a drink, that the last words of most captains before their aircraft augured into the side of the mountain or broke apart before breaking the plane of the sea, were these. Mother. Mommy. Mom. That lovely woman who once upon a time had read to her from Beverly Cleary would have been devastated at the way her older daughter had followed so rigorously her husband's swath of self-destruction. Any mother would. Finally, she found just enough motor control to form a sentence. But it was neither the two-word apology that was bubbling up inside her, nor the plea to spare her or Enrico the pain that loomed. It was the deepest truth of who she was, because it spoke to how she had lived, and the plain, unvarnished reality that we cannot escape who we are, and most of the time we die as we lived. She turned her head as much as she could so she could meet Buckley's eyes and asked, her voice still fuzzy from the shock and paralysis, "Please, can I have a drink?" He paused, seeming to give the request serious, genuine consideration, his eyes almost mystified, and for a long second Cassie believed that she had bought another moment of life, one last taste of the essentia, the ambrosia, the Amrita that filled her veins and her soul and kept her pain at bay. But then he shook his head ever so slightly, almost wistfully, and detached a long, circular tube, a silencer, Cassie presumed, to the end of Enrico's uncle's Beretta.
Federal Bureau of Investigation. FD-302, redacted. Major Dennis McCauley, Army Chemical Corps. Date, August 6, 2018. Dennis McCauley, date of birth, social security number, telephone number, was interviewed by properly identified special agents Richard Marini and Kathy Manning in a private conference room at the Bluegrass Army Depot in Richmond, Kentucky. Manning led the interview. Marini took these notes. After being advised of the nature of the interview, McCauley provided the following information. McCauley acknowledged seeing his sister-in-law, Cassandra Bowden, on Saturday afternoon and evening, August 4th, in New York City, and insisted that her behavior was mostly normal. She went with his family to the Bronx Zoo and then to a restaurant in Lower Manhattan. He noticed that she was checking her phone more than most adults would throughout the day and during dinner, and definitely seemed nervous about something. He said he cannot recall ever seeing her without his wife, Rosemary Bowden McCauley, present. He said the two of them have never emailed or spoken on the phone. He stated firmly that he has never shared any classified information with Bowden, and Bowden has never asked him for any. He said that while they have discussed life in the military very generally and his background as an engineer, they always talked more about her job than his. He denied ever giving her papers, data, diagrams, flash drives, or emails that had anything to do with the disposal of chemical weapons or the remaining U.S. stockpile. He insisted that he never shared any information on sarin, VX, or any chemical weapons not yet destroyed in the U.S. arsenal. He said he never took work home. He said there was no way that his wife, Rosemary, could have shared any information with her sister or provided Cassandra Bowden with classified intelligence because he didn't tell her anything. He said he was shocked that his sister-in-law might have killed Alex Sokolov, though he acknowledged that she has a drinking problem. He volunteered that he does not believe she is a Russian spy.
Chapter 35. But Buckley didn't shoot. Instead, almost as if it were happening to someone else, as if it were an out-of-body experience, Cassie saw him dragging her by her arms further into the hotel room and away from the door. Her dress had rolled up near her hips, and she felt the rug burning her thighs. Intellectually, she welcomed the discomfort. It suggested that feeling and mobility were returning. When they reached the bed, he let her go, dropping her unceremoniously onto the floor beside it, as if she were a canoe dragged from the beach, and then sat down on the edge of the mattress and pointed the Beretta down at her chest.
"Yell for help and I'll kill you," he said.
Cassie tried to shake her head. She was indeed able to move it. "I won't," she murmured, her voice still mushy and hoarse. She tried to focus anywhere but on the tip of the long silencer at the end of the pistol.
"Tell me about Elena."
"Elena?" Instantly, he switched the gun to his other hand, grabbing it by the barrel, and wrapped her hard on the shin with the grip. She closed her eyes and cried out reflexively against the pain, and when she opened them, he was already aiming the weapon at her once more. She collected herself and whimpered. "I don't know who that is."
"The woman who came to Alex Sokolov's suite in Dubai."
"Miranda?" He rolled his eyes.
"Miranda," he repeated.
"We had a drink. The vodka she brought, then she left." He pounded her other shin with the gun, but either because she was expecting it or had just experienced precisely this agony, this time she merely grunted through her tears.
"What were you doing with her?"
"I told you, drinking, that's all."
"Did she recruit you?"
"Recruit me?"
"Cassie, let me be clear. The only chance you have of walking out of this hotel room alive is if you give me the names. You knew Elena, obviously. Who else is embedded?"
"Embedded? I don't know what you mean. I don't understand any of this," she told him. She was crying now and didn't care. "Recruits? Embedded? I'm not a spy. I'm nothing. You know me. You know what I am. I'm just..."
"Why didn't she kill you?"
"I don't know. I'm telling you, I don't know anything," she whimpered. He stared at her and seemed to think about this. Then,
"I almost believe you. Almost."
"Because I'm telling you the truth."
"Tell me about your brother-in-law."
"He's in the army," she mumbled. "He's a major. He's stationed at Bluegrass."
"What else?"
"There is no what else." He stood up, his feet on either side of her body, and aimed the Beretta straight down at her.
"You are fast running out of time, Cassie. Why were you with Sokolov in Dubai?"
"We met on the plane. That's all there was to it," she mewled. "Please don't kill me."
"Why was he interested in you?"
Why was any man interested in her? She wanted to ask in return. The answer was simple. Because she was a drunk and she was easy. And while a small part of her understood the rightness of sarcasm and self-loathing when she appraised her life, there was a gun pointed at her. And so she replied simply, "He wanted a good time. I guess I did too." From the corner of her vision, she saw that Enrico had moved his head. She didn't dare turn her gaze on him because she didn't want to draw Buckley's attention to the young bartender, but Cassie noticed that one of his eyes was open. "He was just a guy on the plane," she went on, hoping to hold Buckley's interest. "Someone to drink with in Dubai. I didn't think I'd ever see him again." She didn't know if there was any way in the world that Enrico could creep over to him without drawing his attention, but the idea gave her hope.
"Did he mention the name of anyone else he was seeing in Dubai?"
"No. I mean, I knew he had a meeting, but I assumed it had something to do with his hedge fund."
"Did he mention anyone else who worked at the airline?"
"No, he didn't." She tried to watch Enrico with soft eyes, eyes that focused on nothing but took in everything. Her friend Paula had grown up with a horse, and it was how she was taught to ride. To see her surroundings without turning her head, and thus confusing the animal beneath her by moving her body. Enrico had managed to inch a little closer to the bed from his spot outside the bathroom. any moment, she supposed, he was going to dive at Buckley. When he did, if she could move quickly, which she was unsure if she could, she would try and help. She would attack too. Years ago, she'd taken a voluntary self-defense course the airline had offered. She'd never needed to use anything she'd learned. Or, alas, she'd been too drunk to realize that she should be defending herself. And she tried to recall what the instructors had taught in the class. There was something about pulling your assailant into you when he had his hands on you, elbowing his head, poking or punching his abdomen. She could do that. She would do anything to force the man by the bed to deal with multiple attacks.
I'm about to go through your suitcase and your kit. I am going to empty everything onto the floor. Sensation should be returning about now. Do not get up off the floor, and do not try and stop me. Are we clear?
She nodded. But then Buckley swung his arm as if swatting someone with the back of his hand. He'd seen Enrico. And calmly pulled the trigger of Uncle Piero's Beretta. Chapter 36. The gun exploded, the silencer dampening but not eliminating the pop, and Cassie was aware that she had winced and cried out, and that Enrico was still alive. He had launched himself on top of Buckley, pinning him on his side on the mattress. There was a cut on Buckley's cheek, the gash already puddling red, and he was holding his right hand with his left. The wound on his hand looked far worse than the one on his face. Cassie could see blood streaming down the man's forearm, as well as the black burns along his fingers and thumb. His index finger was misshapen and either dislocated or broken. Their eyes met, and he snapped at her.
You can't even fucking load a gun!
And then Cassie saw the Beretta on the floor beside her, twisted metal shards rising like tentacles from the rear of the pistol, the silencer straight but dangling from the tip of the still-smoking weapon. They stared at each other, and Cassie understood that this was why Enrico was still alive. She'd failed to load the gun properly.
"Call for help," Enrico said to her. "Call downstairs."
He had wrapped his arms around Buckley, and they looked almost like lovers, and she recalled momentarily what it had been like when she had wrapped herself around him. Then she struggled to her feet, wobbly, her legs like licorice, but she held on to the side of the desk and reached gingerly for the phone.
"Don't,"
said Buckley, and he spat something, a tooth, Cassie saw, into the carpet. Cassie paused long enough for him to continue.
"I'm telling you, you can't hide from us all. There'll just be someone else after you tomorrow."
Outside, they heard guests in the hallway, some returning from the street where they had gone when they had been evacuated from the hotel, some drawn by the sound of the gun exploding. It was clear, however, that none had any idea what that noise was or where it had come from. She heard someone suggest that it must have been something on television, and someone else argue no, it was too loud, and speculate that it had something to do with the air conditioning. Maybe something to do with whatever had triggered the fire alarm that had sent them out into the night in the first place. Neither guest sounded concerned. Cassie continued to stare at Buckley. His right cheek was growing black, and his right eye was disappearing into the swelling all around it.
"Who are you?" she asked. "Tell me now, who are you really?"
She kept her finger on the button for guest services. "Say it like you mean it." When had she said that, Cassie wondered. And then she remembered. She'd challenged her mother to reassure her that everything would be okay when Daddy was so drunk he couldn't navigate his way up the stairs and kept falling down as if he were battling a degenerative muscle disease. Apparently, her mother had not been especially convincing when she'd said everything was fine. For a second, Cassie thought she must have said those words to an old boyfriend, too. Maybe he'd said he loved her in a joshing sort of way, and she'd wanted more. Maybe she'd felt betrayed by the lightness of the way he'd spoken.
Maybe she'd felt betrayed then, too. No. That wasn't it. Because that had never happened. She'd never had a boyfriend who'd told her he loved her. Never. Cassie looked at the blood congealing on Buckley's fingers. Clearly, this was a betrayal of a new sort, at once bigger and smaller than any she'd experienced before in her life. It was bigger because the stakes were bigger. It was smaller because she hadn't really known him. She'd only gotten drunk with him a couple of times. She'd only had sex with him a couple of times. Only. The sad truth was, she really hadn't known him at all. She watched Buckley try once to extricate himself from Enrico, wriggling and struggling to free his arms or his hands, and she started toward the men on the bed to help keep him restrained. But it was evident that Buckley was in a lot of pain, and Enrico was deceptively strong. Buckley wasn't going anywhere. He ran his tongue through the slot where a moment ago he'd had an upper incisor.
"It doesn't matter. My name, I mean," he said when the brief scuffle was done.
He sounded, and the irony was not lost on Cassie, drunk. "It does."
"Then it's Yevgeny."
"Not Buckley?"
"No."
"You're not really an actor, are you? You're not really from Westport. It was all a lie, wasn't it?" He rolled his eyes and then nodded. "And that was you following me around New York City," she said, not a question this time.
"It was."
"You work with Miranda?"
"I thought I did." "I didn't. Not really. Her real name was Elena. Elena Orlov."
"Was."
"Was."
"She's dead?" asked Cassie, at once relieved and strangely, unexpectedly saddened. "God, how? Why?" She noticed the blood on the carpet by the door as she spoke, recalled Alex's on the sheets of that magisterial bed in Dubai, and had a feeling that the great stain this time was Elena's.
"Because she didn't kill you. That was the first clue. We have a feeling she was turned when she went to school in Boston. She was working for you folks now."
"America?"
"America."
"So you're Russian intelligence?"
"I'm nothing."
Enrico elbowed him hard in the back. He grimaced and then said,
"Yes, FSB. I'm a Cossack. Google it."
Then he said to Enrico,
"You don't need to wreck my kidney, and you don't need to suffocate me. I think we've established I'm not going anywhere. So let up on the chest, okay, buddy?" "Call Cassandra. Call,"
Enrico told her.
"Don't talk to this crazy person." "No, Cassie, don't call. Put the phone down," Buckley said. "You'll find Elena's purse in the bathroom. It's beside her body. And in that purse is a gun. Another gun. It's a Beretta that's already loaded, and so, thank God, you won't have to load it. You won't have to do anything. There's also a knife. If you really aren't with the CIA, I'm sure by now you have some new friends with the FBI in New York. Call them. Tell them to call their legal attaché in Rome. Tell them that Elena Orlov is here in this hotel in room 621. She's dead. Tell them Yevgeny Stepanov is in room 406. I'm two floors below you. I'll be waiting for the FBI attaché there. Then, when I've left your room, count to 30, fire the weapon, and scream for help."
Enrico shook his head.
"Don't do it, Cassandra. He's just going to run away." "No, man, I won't. I have no place left to run."
"I want to know one thing," Cassie asked. "Is my brother-in-law clean?"
"As far as I know."
"So you have an inside elsewhere?"
"So it would seem."
Cassie put down the phone. She took her finger off the button for guest services. Then she retrieved Elena Orlov's purse from the bathroom, careful at first to avert her eyes from the corpse in the tub, but then incapable of not glancing at it. There she was. Miranda. Elena. She was on her side, but Cassie could still see how deeply into her neck Buckley had run a knife, and the blood that was pooling near the drain. She took the bag from the bathroom, and in the hallway went through it. She wasn't sure what to make of half of what was inside it. The pills, the restraints. But she found the knife and the Beretta. She flipped off the safety on the weapon.
"Remember, that gun is properly loaded," Yevgeny said to her when she returned.
"Go on."
"Point the gun at me. It's fine. You'll feel safer. Then your friend can let me go. He'll stand next to you. You'll hand me the knife. Or if you want to keep your distance, you can toss the knife onto the mattress. I think I've already left enough blood on the bedspread and the carpet, but a little more couldn't hurt. And my tooth is already there, on the floor. So there will be plenty for forensics. Then I'll go to my room and you'll call your FBI contacts and tell them where I am."
"And hotel security?"
"No. Don't call them. That will lead to the Italian police and a real investigation. I want the world, at least my world, to believe you shot me dead. You killed me."
Enrico was shaking his head no, his eyes imploring her not to do this. Cassie wondered if he'd even release Yevgeny when she asked him to. He might not. She thought of all the mistakes she had made with her life, all the pain she had sown and reaped, all the things she would never have and never do. But she had a feeling now that listening to Yevgeny wasn't going to be one of them. "What about me?" she asked. "You said that even if I kill you or call the police, there will just be someone else coming after me."
"You'll be someone new. Your people will see to it."
"I assume by my people, you don't mean the airline."
"Look, Cassie, think about it. Do you really want to go through life as the cart tart killer?" "I doubt it. Right now, we share something I never expected when I followed you to that bar in the East Village. The need to start again."
Federal Bureau of Investigation. FD-302, Megan Briscoe, flight attendant. Date, August 7th, 2018. Megan Briscoe was interviewed by properly identified special agents Nancy Saunders and Emery Leary at the FBI office in Washington, D.C. Saunders conducted the interview. Leary took these notes. When asked point-blank if she had ever acted as a courier or delivered classified documents or information to a foreign government, she broke down and said that she had. She admitted that she and her husband were both paid by the Russian Federation. He would use his security clearance as a consultant to bring her materials on, most recently, the U.S. Chemical Weapons Defense Program at the Edgewood Chemical Biological Center in Maryland, and she in turn would deliver them to her handlers overseas. She asked for a lawyer, and the interview ended with her arrest and the arrest of her husband. Subsequent to the interview, Briscoe's home and garage in Centerville, Virginia, were searched, and two flash drives with classified chemical weapons information were found hidden in an electrical outlet box behind the plate in their master bedroom.
Epilogue. Remember that person you wanted to be? There's still time. On the night flight to Moscow, Cassie brought the passenger in 4C his vodka and tonic and hovered over him an extra-long second, a noctivagant cat on the headrest of an easy chair. If she hadn't known who he really was, or at least what the agency had told her about him, she would have pegged him for a retired ice hockey star. The sort of red-haired Russian Adonis who, as a very young skater, had led his own country's team to Olympic gold and then taken the NHL by storm in his 20s. He'd clearly broken his nose at least once. His shoulders were still broad, but his hair was thin and his skin was leather. He used reading glasses. She guessed he was, much to her horror, her age. He wasn't a hockey player, of course. He was Russian intelligence.
Maybe a Cossack, but perhaps a part of the FSB's Center 18. The cyber spies. After she had absorbed all she could glean from his tablet, two email addresses and some names she barely could spell, she retreated to the first-class galley and wrote down what she saw. She presumed she was giving the agency nothing they didn't already have. But you never knew. She liked this sort of walk-on role, which was about all they would offer her at this stage. She'd been sober 2 years now, but she had a long history of drinking to overcome, and so this special surveillance group was the extent of the leash. She had new hair and a new name. She had a new base. And when they needed a flight attendant, they used her. Apparently, they had an Aegean stable-sized pool of actors available for this sort of bit part. And she was good at the work. The circumlocutions of the functioning alcoholic were not unlike the daily subterfuge of a spy. The irony to this particular assignment, of course, was that an awful lot of what the agency knew about the gentleman in 4C they had learned from Yevgeny. Or Buckley, as she still thought of him sometimes. The passenger was a friend of Victor's. Yevgeny's knowledge ranged from drop sites to bank account numbers. He knew what everyone liked to drink and their tastes in women and men. He had a new identity, too, but they were still keeping him in a safe house just outside of Washington, D.C. His debriefing, given his history, could last a lifetime. Cassie had seen him just one time since Rome. 4 months ago, when Masha was almost a year old, a handler had brought them together at an apartment near DuPont Circle. It was maybe a block from the Carnegie Endowment, and the handler had made it clear that this was not where Yevgeny lived. The purpose of the meeting was for the Russian to share firsthand what he knew about a woman whom Cassie was supposed to watch on a flight to Beirut. They never told her Yevgeny's new name, and he didn't volunteer it. But his hair now was short, a creamy mix of white and blonde, and Cassie wondered if it was bleached or whether the chestnut she recalled when they'd first met had been the dye. Probably his natural color was the shade she recalled from that summer, the nights when they'd danced together at a grunge bar south of her apartment and walked through the West Village beneath a perfect half-moon. Or the night when he'd killed a woman named Elena and tried to kill a man named Enrico. The night when he would just as easily have killed her. When they met in Washington, Yevgeny had struck Cassie as neither happy nor unhappy. Mostly he seemed comfortable and businesslike in his new role. But when he smiled, she glimpsed the playfulness she remembered. Cassie had made a small joke about her boyfriend, a TV writer in L.A., and Yevgeny confessed that he had watched a few episodes of the Fellows show. For a moment, Cassie had been taken aback that he knew so much about her, even now. But then she had nodded. Of course he did. Then he'd said,
"They really should stick to family drama. Waspy family drama. And if they want me to play the rebellious son who becomes an actor, I'm their man."
His eyes went wide when he said that, and Cassie honestly wasn't sure if he was pulling her leg. Before they parted, Cassie had asked if there was anyone he missed in Russia or America. She wasn't sure why. She guessed it was because they all presumed he was dead. He'd chuckled and said,
"Trust me. You don't want to meet my friends. You just don't. They make me look pretty damn American."
"What does that mean?"
"Wimpy."
Again, she had a sense he was teasing her. But then he sat forward and folded his hands together.
"How wimpy, you ask?"
She waited, wondering whether he was going to make a joke at the expense of the United States. But instead he continued,
"So wimpy, I am very, very glad you screwed up when you loaded that gun. I wouldn't have wanted you on my conscience."
"Because?"
"Because you are just too damn much fun. You're a mess, Or, I don't know, maybe you were a mess. But you sure as hell were good company.
Then he unclasped his fingers as if they were a balloon exploding and added,
And I have a feeling you're not nearly the shitstorm of a mother you probably figured you'd be.
She rolled her eyes. Being sober helps.
You named her Masha, right?
She nodded.
That can't possibly be a family name.
Tolstoy, the young woman in Happy Ever After. She's my happy ending.
God, I remember you reading that,
he said, his own happiness at the recollection genuine. Then...
You still dance barefoot?
I have other pleasures. Board books, sippy cups shaped like animals, teething. He made a tisk-tisk sound with his tongue, pretending to reproach her. Then they parted. Now, as she stood in the dimmed cabin light and looked at the note she had written down about the passenger in 4C, she recalled, as she did rather often, the way Masha would nurse. She would latch on to Cassie and drink with the same fervor with which Cassie knew she had once drunk tequila. Those little baby eyes would grow intense, then sated, and it was in those moments that Cassie could see in them Masha's father, that enigmatic man who had loved Tolstoy and washed her hair ever so tenderly in a lavish hotel suite one night in Dubai. She thought of that quote she'd seen on a blackboard outside a West Village boutique. Remember that person you wanted to be? There's still time. She wasn't completely sure this was who she wanted to be, but she found the work offered the same adrenaline rush as drinking, but without the hangovers and humiliations. It gave her life purpose. She knew, however, that the person who had most assuredly saved her life was Masha, because Masha was the reason she had stopped drinking, and Masha was warmth in the morning when Cassie was home, and they would wake together. And Masha was a euphoric squeal when she would return to her from a trip. Masha was the word moon, her first word, and how with her authoritarian little pointer finger, she had looked skyward at dusk at a sickle moon and elongated that single lovely syllable almost into song. Masha gave her something she loved more than herself, something that didn't come in a glass with ice cubes, or a paper umbrella, or a straw. Cassie opened the first-class bar on the flight, looked at the liquor bottles, as beautiful to her as Fabergé eggs, and reached for a can of Diet Coke. This is Erin Spencer. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Flight Attendant by Chris Bajalian. This program was directed by Bruce Mann. Executive Producer, Kelly Gilday. Text copyright 2018 by Chris Bajalian. Production copyright 2018, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.